So I remind you that we are dealing with an energy functional, which is the Hartree-Fock energy functional. Up to now, we haven't defined the Dirac-Fock yet. So this functional depends on a variable which is capital phi, and capital phi is a collection of n wave functions. So I should have, so I'll remind you that phi is phi 1 phi n, so each phi k is, and this I think I hadn't been precise on this fact, but each phi k, if we want to be precise on the functional space, we will ask phi k to be in H1 of R3 with values 2c. H1 because we want this term to be well defined. Now, by the standard Hardy inequality, which says that 1 over x squared phi k squared is integrable when you are in H1. So by the standard Hardy inequality, you see that this term is well defined, since 1 over x is nicer than 1 over x squared. Okay, and similarly, one can show that this term is well defined, provided all the phi k's are in H1. So this functional is well defined in H1. In fact, it's also smooth. In fact, it's a polynomial of degree 4 in the variables phi 1, phi n. So there were two normality requirements, phi k star, phi l integrated equal delta k l. So something I stated two theorems, one existence of a minimizer under these constraints, and the other was the existence of infinitely many critical points. The peculiarity was that there was an additional information on the epsilon case. So I said that in the case of the ground state, the epsilon case are the first eigenvalues, so counted in with multiplicity, are the first eigenvalues of the mean field Hamiltonian H phi. And I also said that in the case of critical points, the epsilon k's were strictly negative. Before going to Dirac-Fock, I would like to explain the reason why these epsilon k's have these properties, because it's going to be fundamental in the rest of the discussion when we talk about the relativistic case. And that's really the main difficulty in the proof, in the existent proof of Lipp-Simon and also of Pierre Williams. The main difficulty is how do you get information in the epsilon case? You see, the epsilon case, from what I explained, the epsilon case are Lagrange multipliers associated to these constraints. Okay, so usually when you have Lagrange multipliers, you don't know exactly their value. You can have very good information on, say, a min-max level where it is located. You can have estimates, but usually for the eigenvalues, for the Lagrange multipliers, you don't have very precise information. So in fact, this information will come from Morse index information. So I would like to explain that. And I would like to also to explain a very very nice property of this functional, which makes things possible. In fact, this functional, as I said, is non-linear. This is quartic of order 4. But in some sense, it has some linear properties. Namely, if I freeze phi 2, phi n, so if phi 2, phi n are fixed, and if I just move phi 1, then, in fact, the energy E is a quadratic form in phi 1. And of course, things are the same if I freeze phi 1 and I just move phi 2. Okay? And the reason is, you see this nonlinear term here is the interaction, describes the interaction between electrons. But an electron doesn't interact with itself, it interacts with the others. So if you just move one wave function, it does not interact with itself, so it just sees the mean field created by the others. So in fact, this expression are misleading, because they contain contributions of all the electrons. Okay, but there is a simplification. If we write explicitly what rho is, if we replace rho by its expression here and by its expression here, there is a constellation which appears, and in fact, rho of x, rho of y, minus r of xy squared is, so rho of x, rho of y, it's a sum k l of phi k of square x phi l square y, okay, minus phi k of x phi k of y star times phi l of x star phi l of y, if I don't make any mistakes. Now if I take k equal to l, I see that this term vanishes. So in fact, I can impose that k is different from l. It doesn't change anything. Okay, there's a constellation which appears, and this constellation exactly tells you that that an electron doesn't interact with itself. And so as a result, if I write E of phi 1, phi 2, and I put a note here to say that I freeze phi 2, phi n, and I just move phi 1, okay, then what I get is exactly this. I get a splitting, so phi 1, scalar H, capital phi 1, phi 1, I'm going to explain what is phi 1, plus another energy which depends only on phi 2, phi n. So, and what is H phi 1? Well, H phi 1 is a mean field, Hamiltonian associated to phi 1, where phi 1 is just the collection of phi 2, phi n. That is, by phi 1, I mean I have taken phi and I have removed a capital phi 1, I mean I have removed phi 1. Okay? So you have the same thing. I mean, if you freeze phi k, you're going to have a similar expression. Okay? So this is a quadratic form, and I can put a note here because this quadratic form is fixed if I just move this phi 1 here. Okay? Okay, so this is a. Okay, and also the Dirac Fock equation, they can be written in this form. Okay, H capital phi k is epsilon k phi k, where phi k is just phi 1, where you remove phi k. Okay, it's just this. Okay, so why is this important? Well, it's important because I'm not going to prove the theorem, the Lipp-Simon theorem. So, and this is just I did not say what this is. This is just the Hartree Fock energy, but only with the wave functions phi 2 up to phi n. Okay, so. Now, idea of proof of Lipp-Simon's theorem. In fact, I'm not going to prove Lipp-Simon's theorem, but the Lipp-Simon's property that epsilon k's are the first n eigenvalues. Okay, I'm going to explain that. Why are they the first n eigenvalues? So, suppose, I'm cheating a little bit, suppose we have found a minimizer. Okay, so suppose, so of course I'm cheating because you have to prove that the minimizer exists, but so suppose phi star is a minimizer. Okay, now, so it's a minimizer of E under constraints, under constraints integral of phi k. So when I write phi k star, I mean the complex conjugate. So this is a little bit misleading with this. Well, so here also that's what I meant, the complex conjugate, okay? Maybe it's better to write it like that. So under the constraint phi k bar phi l equal delta k l. So if phi star is a minimizer, then it means that the map which to phi 1 associates E of phi 1, phi 2 star, phi n star has a minimum at phi 1 star. Okay, if I have a minimum with respect to all variables, I have a minimum with respect to one of these variables. Okay, and I should say that there are constraints. And the constraints are that integral of phi 1 squared should be 1, and that integral of phi 1 phi k bar should be 0 for any k equal 2 to n. Okay, now you have to remember what I just said before. In fact, the energy if you freeze phi 2 phi n is a quadratic form in phi 1. Now, what is the minimizer of a quadratic form? Well, it's just the eigenvector which corresponds to the smallest eigenvalue. Okay, so maybe I should so phi 1 star satisfies H capital phi 1, there are stars everywhere, equal some I call epsilon 1 phi 1 star, and epsilon 1 is the first eigenvalue of well, this is not completely yes, there are these orthogonality conditions, but we already know, I mean, we already know that we have this, okay? So I suppose I have a minimizer, so it's a critical point. Yes, I've been cheating a little bit. We already know that it satisfies such Lagrange equations, but now we don't know what the epsilon k's are. We don't know where they are. Okay, so we know that. Okay, this is the Euler Lagrange equation. Okay, now. From what I said, epsilon 1, must be the first eigenvalue of not exactly of H phi 1 star, but H phi 1 star projected on the orthogonal space of phi 2 phi n. Okay, now it turns out that we don't have to project because we already know that we have an eigenvalue, so we really have the smallest so we stay here. Now how do we conclude? Well, now what we know it's easy to see that H phi as an operator is greater than or equal to H phi 1. Why? Because in H phi, the mean field operator of the beginning, there is this additional interaction due to phi 1. And it's a repulsive interaction. So you have an inequality like that. So if epsilon 1 is the first eigenvalue of H phi 1 projected in this space, it is also the first eigenvalue of H phi projected on that space, because the eigenvalues of H phi will be higher than the eigenvalues of H phi 1, and because we already know that epsilon 1 is a common eigenvalue to H phi and H phi 1. So here I can replace phi by phi 1 because of this property. Okay, this is, we know that in fact. Okay, because of the magic constellation. So now I can say that it's also, so I can replace H phi by H phi 1, H phi 1 by H phi here. Okay. And then when I have a property like this, so now I have the same operator for all these guys, and I can make exactly the same argument with all the phi k's. Okay. Or say capital phi minus phi k orthogonal. Okay, the collection of all the phis, but you just get rid of phi k. So now when you have a property like that, it immediately implies that epsilon 1, epsilon n are the first eigenvalues of H phi. Okay. I mean, it's linear algebra. You have n eigenvalues. Each one is the smallest eigenvalue of the operator projected on the orthogonal of the other eigenvectors. Okay. You must have that. Okay. So what was essential was really to have this property of being a quadratic form when you freeze the other eigenvectors. Now, for the existence of excited states of critical points, the idea is the same. You have to, instead of using the fact that you are a minimizer, so here we use the fact that we had a minimizer, and what was hidden, we were using the a second order characterization of minimizers. When I speak of the quadratic form, in fact, I am thinking of the second derivative. I'm using this implicitly. Now, if you are interested in excited states, well, you have to use a Morse index information. I'm not going to give the details, but how are the excited states formed? Well, they are formed by some min-max argument involving the genus, the Z2 index theory. So they are formed by min-max on a class of surfaces of finite dimensions, say, and by well-known theorems of variational theory. One can say that if you are lucky, if you have good assumptions, you get critical points of finite Morse index. So there's a difficulty here that I'm hiding because we don't have Palace mail. But suppose that we have found, suppose that H phi k is epsilon k phi k. So you have found a critical point and Morse index of phi with respect to the functional phi is some j finite. Okay? Suppose you have this, which the variational methods give you. Okay? Variational methods give you that. So what is the Morse index? I remind you, it is the highest dimension, the highest possible dimension of a vector space on which the second derivative, the Hessian, of the functional is negative definite. Okay? So, well, the idea now is exactly the same. What we are going to say is, if there is no vector space of dimension greater than J, so that the second derivative of the functional is negative definite on this space, well, then if I restrict the functional to one direction, we will have the same property. That is, one cannot find a vector space of dimension more than J, on which this the quadratic form, which corresponds to this map, is negative definite. Okay, so there is no space V included in H1 of dimension greater than J, such that the Hessian and
how do you know that you have these excited states?
Well, they are formed by variational method that I don't explain here. Okay, they are formed by min-max argument.
Okay, but these arguments don't need the Morse index already, or?
No, this argument gives you the Morse index information. Okay, so you have, for instance, if you have a minimization argument, you minimize a functional, then you know at the end that the minimizer should have zero Morse index. Okay, now if you do a mountain pass, then you know that the mountain pass point, if it exists, should have index at most one, etc. That's the topology gives you the Morse.
Okay, so basically this Morse index information is sort of a theorem after
a experiment. Yeah, there are many people who, yes, there are many works on that. In fact, you can look at the book of Gusub, for instance, where everything is explained, where all the results are quoted. So the topology gives you this Morse index information. Now, once you know, Once you translate this Morse index information on one channel, in one direction, then you end up with interpreting a Morse index information for a quadratic form. Okay. And now let me give you a very simple lemma. If I consider the map. So I work in Rn. I consider this map for x. Which satisfies norm of x equal 1. If I have a critical point corresponds to an eigenvector, okay, of A. So take a critical point, so x star, so x naught, say x naught, which satisfies x naught, ax naught equal lambda naught x naught. Okay, and now suppose that the Morse index of x0 is k, then is j, then lambda naught is the j's eigenvalue of A. So in fact, the Morse index gives you exactly the position of the eigenvalue of A. Okay. Okay, I don't want to, it's a simple computation. So you can translate, of course it works also in infinite dimension, and you can translate, and this tells you that epsilon 1 is at most, because we just have an inequality in fact there, okay, is at most the jth eigenvalue of H phi. Okay. So epsilon k so here I'm we should not forget that we have some orthogonality with the others, so we should ask plus n the j plus n minus 1 eigenvalue of H phi. Okay, so this Morse index information tells you that that the epsilon k's cannot be if I count them so in non-decreasing order with multiplicity, they have a finite they're at a finite rank. So since we know that the spectrum of H phi is like that, with infinitely many negative eigenvalues, this tells you immediately that the eigenvalues are negative. Okay? So if we were here, the Morse index would be infinite. No. We don't know, for instance, it's not known if you can prescribe, so the correct question would be, so you have H phi here, okay, and you have, you could say, I want a solution of a self-consistent field so that epsilon 1, say, is the first one, epsilon 2 is the third one, epsilon 3 is that you cannot say. It's not known. That would be interesting from the chemical viewpoint, for instance, to say that the first three the first three levels are filled, and then you have just one electron which goes here. It would have an interpretation as an excited state for only one electron, but that is not known. It's an open question. Okay. So.
So basically, each time you go to an excited state, somehow all the orbitals change.
Yeah, you don't really control. And the reason is this Morse index calculation is not very precise. In fact, this is precise, but what is not precise is that we have an information on the Hessian, on the Morse index, which is a global information for all the wave functions moving together. And now we freeze these eigenfunctions and we just look at this one. Of course, we do also the same by looking at this one and freezing the others. But this is not good because you have a full space and you just look at a finite number of directions, so you get only a partial information. Okay, so this is not optimal.
What is the precise result of this? What is the statement?
Oh, so the statement, the final statement, is relating the Morse index, which is not, I mean, it's a statement which is written nowhere. But it follows implicitly from the proof in Lyon's paper. So the final statement relating the Morse index to the location of the eigenvalues is the following. So say proposition. Suppose H phi k is epsilon k phi k. And integral of phi k phi l bar is delta k l, and Morse index of phi is at most j. Then, if we call lambda 1, lambda n, etc., which converge to zero. The negative eigenvalues of H phi, okay, so H phi is the mean field operator, so it has eigenvalues. Okay. Etc. So here I don't put strict inequalities, they can be degenerate, but then you count them with multiplicity. We have that epsilon k is lambda n of k for some n, okay? Because you see the epsilon k's are in fact eigenvalues, so you can find indices so that the epsilon k's are n of k, and maximum over k of n of k minus k is less than or equal to j. And this corresponds, this comes from this estimate. Okay? Well, that's the result. And this is not optimal because it's easy to see that if we did not have the nonlinearity, if we did not have this rho and r intervening, I could consider, say, an abstract problem in finite dimension. You map to x1, xn, the sum of the xk, a xk, for some symmetric matrix A. So this would be the model for electrons which do not interact together under constraints phi xk scalar xl equals delta kl. And now I can describe very precisely the relationship between the location of eigenvalues and the Morse index. So if spectrum of A is lambda 1, lambda n, okay, and eigenvalues, and if I have a solution, if I have a critical point of this map, so what does the critical point of this map do? Well, it's the same equations as the Hartree fork, but simpler. You have A xk equal epsilon k xk for any k. Okay, for a critical point, you will have this simplified Hartree fork equations. Okay, if I look for a critical point of this map, this functional under these constraints, I have exactly the same Euler-Lagrange equation as for Hartree fork, but simpler because they are linear.
Because A is fixed.
Okay, and then you have a very nice formula. Morse index of x1 xn equals the sum of the n of k minus k, where epsilon k is lambda n of k. Okay? So in that case, it's linear algebra. It's very simple. So you see there's a difference between this formula and this formula.
It's the same A.
So what happens is that instead of just moving in fixed directions, you can move in any direction in the space of functions of points x1, xn. And then you get a full information. Okay? So it clearly shows that this is not optimal. And this is a reason why you cannot get very precise information on where are the critical points. The only moment when you get the precise information is when j equals 0, because then, of course, the two formulas coincide. Okay, so that's all what I wanted to say about Hartree fork, and I've been quite long already. Now let me go to So Dirac Fock. So what is the difference? Well, mainly the difference is that we are going to replace Laplacian by the Dirac operator. And the big problem is that the Dirac operator is not positive definite. And so what I just said about the Morse index fails because the Morse index becomes infinite. So the natural idea then is to say, well, we are going to use some renormalized Morse index. But then you have to be careful because since this formula is not very precise, this will create a lot of trouble when you try to use this renormalized Morse indices. Okay. So let me go to Dirac Fock. So how do we derive Dirac Fock? We are not going to derive it directly from a very nice n-body linear equation as I did for Hartree Fock, because this very nice n-body equation is not well defined. In fact, there is no nice n-body Dirac equation with nice properties. So we can forget it. The true theory is quantum electrodynamics, which is really a mess, at least for me. So we don't try to derive the Dirac Fock equation from physical basic principle. We just replace, and that gives something which is which gives good experimental results. So we just replace minus Laplacian over 2 by H naught. So what are our unknowns? Well, I will take the same notation. So phi is a collection of phi 1, phi n. Each phi k leaves now in H1 half of R3 C4. So why H1 half? Because it's a natural space where the quadratic form phi H0 phi is well defined. And why C4? Well, Maria's lectures probably show you that we have to take C4 if we want to consider Dirac. And now we have the same requirement as usual, that integral of phi k bar phi l should be delta k l. So here by phi k bar, I mean you take the rho vector in C4 and you make it a line covector, and this is a scalar product, in fact, in C4, and you integrate. So you have a Dirac Fock functional, which is the integral of the sum of phi k h naught phi k. H naught is the Dirac operator. And then it's almost the same as before. The only difference is that there is a constant here, which was already introduced in Maria Esteban's lecture, which is the fine structure constant. Okay. So physically, alpha is about 1 over 147, but for mathematics, we just take it as a parameter. So it's here. Why is it here? In fact, I should just say a word on this, and I remind you that H naught is minus I sum of the alpha k dk plus beta. We have no physical constants appearing in there. Alpha k are matrices. They have nothing to do with alpha, which is a scalar. It's physical notations. And what should I say? Why is there alpha? Well, because even if you change the physical constants, you can never get rid of this thing. The reason is that d over dk has the same homogeneity as 1 over x. So, So you can do nothing to get rid of a constant here. If you move this, you move also this. And Z, I should remind you that Z is the number of protons in the nucleus. And of course, this model also works for molecules. You can replace this nuclear potential by a potential due to several nuclei. But in numerical computations, to my knowledge, it's mostly used for atoms. Because this model is interesting, in fact, for the inner layers of the atoms, for the electrons which are close to the nucleus of a heavy atom. Why? Because when the atom, when the electrons are close to the nucleus of the heavy atom, they go very fast. Okay. And this model is not. I mean, it's not just a model for. To play. It's really necessary to make relativistic computations when you have heavy atoms. And this Dirac-Fock model is the most commonly used model. Then there are more sophisticated ones, but this is really the basic model. It gives very good experimental results. And to give you an example, if you consider non-relativistic calculations. If you make non-relativistic calculations, and for instance, you do that on the gold atom, okay? And from these computations, you try to see what is the color, to guess what is the color of gold. Then non-relativistic calculations tell you that gold is white, okay? And only with relativistic calculation, you can see that gold is yellow. So it shows you on this example. So gold is heavy, okay, but it's not the most heavy of all atoms. You see that relativistic corrections are absolutely necessary to get good experimental results. Okay, so then you have the Dirac-Fock equations, which are just the same as in the Hartree-Fock case, okay, and the difference is that H phi now is so applied to a wave function psi is just H naught minus alpha z over x plus alpha rho star 1 over x psi minus alpha integral of r of xy over x minus y psi of y. Okay, dy. So you have exactly the same thing. Rho is exactly the same as before. It's just the same, the sum of the phi k of x squared. Note that this is in fact a vector, so it's a norm in C4. Okay, and the difference is R now is a matrix. R is the sum of the phi k of y bar tensor phi k of x. By this, I mean that you take phi k of y and you make it a line vector, a line covector. You take the complex conjugates and you tensor product it with phi k of x, which is a column vector. So the result is a 4x4 matrix. Okay, and when I speak of the norm, square of the norm, I mean the sum of the squares of the coefficients. Okay, but it's a small difference. You can forget it. It's not. Now here comes the big difference. The big difference is when you look at the spectrum of the H phi. So let me give a small lemma. So first of all, you have to be careful because if you remember in Maria Esteban's lectures, if you have the Dirac operator with H naught minus alpha z over x, you see that when alpha z reaches the critical value, which is 1, the operator starts to have very strange properties. It's no longer self-adjoint, etc. But when alpha z is less than 1, there was a spectrum which was like this. Okay? So there were no negative eigenvalues, but there were eigenvalues below 1. etc. And in fact, this picture remains correct under some assumptions on rho and under more restrictive assumptions on alpha z. So assume that n is less than z and alpha z is less than 2 over, oh, I don't have enough room. The alpha z is less than 2 over pi over 2 plus 2 over pi. So if you remember, this constant is a constant which appears in a Hardy type inequality due to Tiks and Burenkov-Evans, and the value of this constant is about 0.9. So we don't exactly reach 1, but so if you have this, then the spectrum, then H phi has a natural self-adjoint extension. So if you are not interested in this, you can forget what I said with domain included in H1 half. Well, this is a technical thing, but the main interesting thing is that the spectrum of H phi is as above. So, as my picture shows, so here you have eigenvalues which depend on phi, in fact. So you have a non-decreasing sequence of eigenvalues which are smaller than 1 and which converge to 1. Okay, then you have the essential spectrum, which is 1 plus infinity minus 1 minus infinity. And then here, in fact, we don't know what varies. There might be eigenvalues, but we don't care. There might be negative eigenvalues, but we don't care. And moreover, there is a forbidden region. There's a red chalk. So let me write the forbidden region in red. So this is 0. No, it's not 0. Sorry. This is 0. And there is a safety region where there are no eigenvalues. And this safety region has a size which is independent of phi. So this has size 2H. H depends only on ZNN. Okay? And this is true. I did not say what I assumed on phi. This holds for any phi such that the Gram matrix of phi, which is a matrix of the scalar products phi k phi l, okay, as long as this matrix is not bigger than the identity matrix. So this is a slightly more general constraint than this. Okay, this is an equality constraint. And here I say that this holds even if you have inequality. Inequality in the following sense. This is a self-adjoint matrix, and the difference between identity and this matrix should be a non-negative self-adjoint matrix. Okay? So as long as you have that, then you have this nice property that, well, you have an essential spectrum, you have positive eigenvalues and infinitely many positive eigenvalues below 1, you have a forbidden region. Here you have something maybe, but we don't care. Okay. If I can have 1 minute, I can state a theorem with. Now, what people want, what physicists and chemists are interested in, is solutions of the self-consistent field equations where epsilon k's lie in there, are between 0 and 1. So we have an existence theorem. Of course, the chemists didn't wait for us to compute the solutions, but uh, but it might be comforting to know that these solutions exist afterwards. So it was published in 1999 in Communications in Physics. And the theorem is that there are infinitely many critical points of the Dirac-Fock equation under the constraints gram phi equal identity. So here the constraints, now I summarize them as gram phi equal identity. Okay. The corresponding epsilon k's are in 0, 1. That is in the good domain. Okay, so sorry for. Oh yeah, there are no assumptions. Great. Thank you. Thank you. okay, so you need these assumptions, okay? But no, in fact, we just need this. Because here, once again, there's a trick as in Hartree-Fock. We assume that alpha z is less than 0.9, but also there is a very bad assumption, and thank you for reminding me. Perhaps I forgot it on purpose, I don't know. So alpha times 3n minus 1 should be less than 0.9. I should say that this has been improved by Eric Paturel in 2000. It appears in Annales de l'Institut Henri Poincaré, where he has the same results without this alpha 3n minus 1 less than 0.9. So, and this is really a non-trivial improvement. I will explain that in the next talk. This is really non-trivial improvement because there was a tweak here which does not work when you get rid of this, and it makes it much, much more intricate. Physically, if you take alpha equal to 1 over 137, this does not cover all existing atoms because n should be less than 41 in there, but here you cover all existing atoms. Sorry for.
Thanks for speaking again.